from Kansas to Kentucky, Arizona to South Dakota, this is American Radio Journal. On this edition, could superheroes help save America? There are lessons to be learned from all those superhero movies and television programs. Travis Smith, author of Superhero Ethics, is here to discuss. Democratic congressional challengers are out fundraising sitting Republicans in a number of districts around the country. Andy Roth of the Club for Growth has the real story. The confirmation process for Supreme Court Justice nominee Brett Kavanaugh is underway. Eric Boehm and Jacob Sullum of Reason Magazine take a look at his past rulings on gun rights and personal liberty. And President Trump's summit with Russian President Vladimir Putin resulted in a huge political uproar. Dr. Paul Kengor from the Center for Vision and Values at Grove City College says it's not the first time such a meeting has made waves. I'm Loman Henry, and welcome to American Radio Journal. Superhero stories are not just for amusement. They have serious moral significance and can teach us important lessons about a free society. So says Travis Smith, author of the new book, Superhero Ethics, an associate professor of political science at Concordia University. Dr. Smith argues superheroes can serve as role models to help save American freedoms. Travis, welcome to American Radio Journal. Travis, you've written a book called Superhero Ethics, and it's interesting that you're able to take the spate of superhero movies that we have coming out these days and relate that to our society and our politics. How do you make that connection?
What I do in Superhero Ethics, Roman, is I try to show that we can treat superhero stories, these artifacts that are often regarded as lowbrow or juvenile amusements, and treat them a bit more seriously, and ask ourselves whether or not the kinds of characters that are featured in those stories that children and adults alike enjoy represent good role models, whether they are the kinds of people that are admirable, worthy of imitation, if we were to follow their example in terms of the kind of character we might come to possess, inculcate in our children, would we be happier as individuals? Would we have a better society?
Of course, at one time, Travis, truth, justice, and the American way was the whole superhero model, but now we have all sorts of different subgenres of superhero movies, films, television series. Is there a particular type of superhero movie that you or television series that you see that does still inculcate those values of responsibility?
The kinds of stories, I can tell you first, the kinds of stories I don't like as much. I don't like the ones so much where there's some sort of calamity, catastrophe, apocalypse on a global scale, and ordinary human beings are stuck looking to super-powered, super-smart, super-capable individuals to play the role of savior, hero, champion, and come to our rescue because we ordinary folk find ourselves feeling helpless, feeling like victims, feeling like we're at the mercy of forces beyond our control and that we'd have no choice but to stand on the sidelines screaming in fear, cheering on our favorites, and hoping that others will save us. Those kinds of stories I find the message that they convey is worrisome. I like the kinds of stories that focus on things on a smaller scale, on a human scale. I enjoyed going to see Ant-Man and the Wasp with my family last week. That one was fun. I like stories such as in the Spider-Man movies. Jessica Jones on Netflix is another one of my favorites, in which it is the case that on the scale of ethics rather than on the scale of grand politics, you see individuals striving to be the best version of themselves that they can be, to take responsibility for not only their actions, but the kind of personality that they have, and find that in being the best version of themselves in a fashion that helps others out without trying to or presuming to boss them around or control them, but helping others become the best versions of themselves are the better role models.
You mentioned in an op-ed that you wrote that And these are your words. Our society too often sanctions timid passivity and outsized outrage. Where have we seen that? All in the name of compassion or justice. And that's the end of your quote. And I'd like you to elaborate on that statement a little bit, Travis, because we see this in our politics where particularly President Trump does something and all of a sudden Facebook and Twitter explodes with outrage from one side. If you criticize the president, it explodes with outrage from the other side. If you don't criticize the president, are we too engaged in outrage these days?
It's funny. I when I treat superheroes in superhero ethics, I tend to downplay the super side of them and even downplay the heroism a little bit. Because if we take them too literally, and in the book I tried to read their characters and their powers more metaphorically, if we take them too literally, you can kind of get the situations I think you're describing where people divide the entire society between heroes and villains, regarding themselves, of course, on the side of goodness, and everybody with whom they disagree not as just someone with whom you might have a reasonable disagreement, but you'd have to find some way to work together, get along, compromise, negotiate, and still regard yourselves as being on the same team as fellow citizens. But instead, we see people looking at others with whom they disagree as if they were villains, as if the only reason you could possibly disagree is because you must be a complete ignoramus or outright malevolent. And under those circumstances where if you're not with us, you're against us, when people adopt that mindset, then you have conflict. You can't but have conflict with people that you regard as evildoers. And so it is the case, however, that by and large, this conflict is, maybe we should be thankful for this, still mostly taking place as it were on social media. Most people don't actually get involved too directly in confronting others in an uncivilized way, but we feel as if we can be heroic so long as we retweet the correct hashtags and the correct memes and add lots of exclamation points to our expressions of our outrage and our fears. I think we are seeing that. In the book, I have a chapter on the Hulk and Wolverine, two superheroes that are prone to behaving in uncivilized ways. And I raise questions there as to whether or not it's possible to be an uncivilized hero. Is it possible to be uncivilized and honorable? Is it possible to be uncivilized and yet keep it under control? Because those would be the big challenges, big difficulties.
You also made an analogy when it comes to public policy. Interesting that you can take superheroes and comic book characters and then analogize them to public policy, where we have problems. And sometimes people look at politics and, as you put it, regulating, prohibiting, persecuting, punishing it. Sometimes we look to government to be a superhero to solve problems that really we ought to be able to deal with on our own in our everyday lives.
Right. I mean, when I look at the superhero characters in superhero ethics, I don't do it in a way just to say three cheers, hurrah, let's imitate them all, these are obviously great. I look at them with a critical eye, and I'm probably tougher on more of them than I am supportive of them. If you take them too literally, then we ought to realize that as solving our problems with power, with coercive force, that is morally problematic. It isn't the model of good citizenship in a society where we regard each other as free and responsible and equal, where we ought to be persuading each other, where we ought to be providing role models of responsible behavior, responsible for ourselves, responsible for our communities, and not depending on coercive force all the time. I looked at certain superheroes like Batman, who seems to favor the use of coercive powers, surveillance technologies, looking for control in order to reduce suffering, rather than trusting other people more than you might prefer to.
We have been talking with Travis Smith. Travis is an associate professor of political science at Concordia University. He is also author of the new book, Superhero Ethics. And Travis, if we have listeners who are maybe had their curiosity piqued a little bit about this, how can they get a copy of Superhero Ethics?
You can get it directly from templetonpress.org. It is also available on Amazon, both in print and in Kindle form. It's available on the Barnes & Noble website as well. So there's a few options right there.
Superhero ethics author Travis Smith. Travis, thank you for being with us.
Thank you very much for having me on American Radio Journal, Noman.
Andy Roth at the Club for Growth has been keeping track of all the various races going on for seats in the U.S. Senate that are up this year, also the United States Congress, and it takes money to do all that. We're going to talk about that a bit today. Andy, good to have you here.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Typically, Andy, incumbents, particularly congressional incumbents, are going to outraise their opponents, but there may be some warning signs here for Republicans in the second quarter finance reports.
As a candidate running for Congress, whether you're an incumbent or a challenger, you have to file quarterly reports with the Federal Election Commission, or the FEC. And the second quarter numbers just came in recently, and it shows a startling trend that we detected during the first quarter, but has picked up in the second quarter, and that is that Democrats, challengers, they are not sitting members of Congress, but Democrat challengers are outraising House Republican incumbents. There are 54 House Republicans, to be precise, 54, which is about a fifth of all House Republicans. That's a startling number. I mean, when you're a member of Congress, you have the power of incumbency. You likely sit on a committee or committees. You likely get PAC checks from K Street. There should be an ample amount of money coming in. And what we're seeing here is that Democrat enthusiasm is so high that these challengers are the ones who are actually raising the money. What's even more startling is of the 54 Democrats who are out raising incumbent House Republicans, 22 of them have brought in over $1 million just in the last 3 months. That's a very large number. I mean, even good performing House incumbents of either on either side of the aisle have a difficult time of raising $1 million a quarter. But these are challengers who have next to zero name ID in their districts who are able to raise over $1 million. That's a very significant thing. So if the Democrats simply won a majority of these seats that they outraised Republicans in, they would have the majority, maybe a little bit more than that, but thereabouts. So if elections were simply decided based on money, and for the most part they are, the Democrats are in a very good position to retake the majority in the House.
As we look at these districts, though, Andy, even though Democrat challengers may be outraising the Republican incumbents, do other perks of incumbency, for example, the name ID that a Republican incumbent might have that a Democrat challenger still needs to achieve, or organizational strength, do those all come into play?
Yeah, I mean, there are so many things that come into play when you consider a House race. Senate races are what most people are used to, and that's because they're bigger and they're more expensive. But each House race is, they're very interesting because each one of them is different. Sometimes they have expensive media markets like New York, Chicago, or Los Angeles, and some of them have very cheap media markets like Topeka, Kansas, or Fort Wayne, Indiana. And so depending on the media markets, it depends on how easily can a candidate get their message out. And then, of course, did the district go for Trump? Did it go for Clinton? Does it lean right? Does it lean left? Is it more purple? The districts that are the most competitive literally are the districts that usually are right there in the middle, where they're just swing districts. So a lot of variables come into play. Incumbency is a powerful thing. You've heard the stats, like over 90% of all incumbents get reelected. That's the case year in and year out, or cycle by cycle. But it does seem that in the midterm election, after a president is elected, it usually goes to the opposing party. And that's evidence of why the Democrats are likely in the best position to regain the House. The Senate is a completely different story, but in the House, I think momentum is still on the Democrat side.
As you mentioned, in the Senate, the momentum is on the Republican side, if only because there are, 23 Democrats and only 10 Republicans up for 23 Democrat and 10 Republican seats up for election this year. But let's talk for a minute about Texas. Texas, of course, is considered to be deep blue, a lock for Republicans. But Beto O'Rourke, who is the Democrat nominee, the challenger against Ted Cruz, he fared really well with fundraising, too.
He did. He is something of a celebrity candidate, is the best way I can explain it. He's just a congressman from El Paso, which is basically that tiny little part of Texas right underneath New Mexico. But he's a young, charismatic guy. He raised a ton of money. He raised $10.4 million, which is a startling amount of money. I don't even think Senate incumbents typically raise that kind of money on either side of the aisle. So what he did is really tap into Democrat enthusiasm for his candidacy, plus Democrats just thoroughly dislike Ted Cruz, and we thank Ted Cruz for that. But I think they smell blood in the water. Now, for Cruz's part, he did just fine as well. He raised $4.6 million, which is a very healthy haul. But Beto O'Rourke has a fundraising advantage. He has $14 million in cash compared to Cruz's $10 million in cash with 4 months to go until Election Day. Now, I should note that this is Texas. This is still a very red state, and we've done polling ourselves that shows that Ted is going to win by 10 points. But, you know, there is this fear that Texas is ever so slowly creeping to the left with each passing election cycle. I think Beto O'Rourke is a little bit ahead of his time, but it's possible that if Republicans don't get their act together, that sometime in the next decade, Texas could turn blue. But until then, I think Ted is just fine getting reelected.
We have been talking with Andy Roth at the Club for Growth. And Andy, a couple of words about the club.
Sure thing. The Club for Growth is a membership organization out of Washington, D.C., but we have over 250,000 members from all across the country, from all walks of life, from all 50 states in the union, and we're united because we believe in economic freedom. If your listeners are interested, they can go to our website at www.clubforgrowth.org, and if they like what they see, they can join for free.
Andy Roth at the Club for Growth. Andy, we'll look forward to talking with you again next week.
Thanks for having me, Loman.
Confirmation hearings will soon begin for President Trump's pick to replace Supreme Court Justice Anthony Kennedy. In advance of that, Eric Boehm and Jacob Sullum of Reason Magazine take a look at Judge Brett Kavanaugh's record on Second and Fourth Amendment rights. Eric?
Judge Brett Kavanaugh has been tapped by President Donald Trump to fill the vacancy on the Supreme Court, and he will be the subject of scrutiny from all sides over the next few weeks and months as he goes through the confirmation process. But today, we're going to take a closer look at two very important areas, two important amendments to the Constitution, to see what Judge Kavanaugh has to say about them. Thanks for joining us, folks. I'm Eric Boehm with Reason Magazine. You're listening to American Radio Journal. My guest today is Jacob Sullum. He's a senior editor for Reason Magazine, and he's a colleague of mine, and he has written extensively over the past week or so about Kavanaugh's views on these two very important amendments, the Second and the Fourth. Spoiler alert, Kavanaugh is very good on one of these issues and, well, not so good on the other. To talk about all of that now, here is Jacob Sullum. Jacob, thanks for taking some time and being with us.
Sure.
Let's start with some of the good from, at least from the libertarian perspective here, and that would be largely what Kavanaugh has written about the Second Amendment. Tell us where he stands on that.
He dissented from a decision where the D.C. Circuit upheld the gun laws in the District of Columbia. These were the laws they adopted after their handgun ban. And basically, it was a ban on having any kind of gun in effect in the home for self-defense. That was overturned, of course, by the Supreme Court. And so this is the law that they passed, D.C. passed after that decision. It included a provision banning so-called assault weapons, which is basically just a bunch of arbitrarily selected rifles and also some shotguns and handguns, but mostly rifles, based on features like adjustable stocks or pistol grips. They also had a registration system that was comprehensive. You had every gun had to be registered, and if it wasn't registered, it was illegal. So there was a three-judge panel, and the majority said, this is fine. This is consistent with the Second Amendment, and Kavanaugh dissented. They said, hang on. The Supreme Court said that it's not okay for D.C. to ban handguns, which are primarily semi-automatic, you know, handguns we're talking about, the most popular kind for self-defense. How is it okay to ban semi-automatic rifles?
The Supreme Court really hasn't heard a big Second Amendment case in quite a while now, Jacob. It's been close to maybe a little more than a decade since the Heller ruling. Does Kavanaugh being on the court mean that we might see more of these cases coming up, since, of course, the justices do play a role in deciding which cases they will hear?
So there are all of these questions, important questions, that have been unresolved. For example, does this right to possess guns extend past your doorstep? It seems a lot logical that it would, since it's the right to keep and bear, you know, arms, but the court has never specifically addressed that issue. Basically, Kennedy and Roberts were preventing these cases from being heard for whatever reason. They didn't want to be striking down gun control laws that were popular, or they didn't want to support the gun control laws. Didn't seem to want to hear these cases, but once Kavanaugh gets on the court, there will be another vote to hear them. So at that point, you will have four justices inclined to overturn gun control laws, and you will have Roberts probably wishing he could avoid the issue, but he won't be able to anymore. So he's going to have to decide where he stands. So that's huge, really.
So let's change gears quickly here and talk about the Fourth Amendment. And you might be wondering why, if you're listening to us, why we're combining these two issues. And so I'll try to explain it like this. Kavanaugh has done a really good job throughout his career of seeing through the chicanery of the government's arguments for gun control. But he's been much more willing to accept sometimes questionable, sometimes pretty stretched logic on arguments from the state about surveillance. And one case in particular that people have been pointing to is a case where Kavanaugh ruled that police putting a tracking device on a suspect's car was an unconstitutional search, but only because he said it was the physical affixing of the device to the car that violated the Fourth Amendment. Once the device is on there, he was fine with the government collecting all that data about where the suspect was going. And that sort of distinction is pretty worrisome for civil libertarians, right, Jacob?
That is the what got a majority in the Supreme Court ultimately in that case. So he didn't like the argument that said attaching this tracker to the car and then tracking the guy for a month was unacceptable because of the amount of information it generated about his whereabouts. There was sort of this argument that if you track somebody for a little while, that's okay, but once you get to a certain point, it becomes a search under the Fourth Amendment. So he didn't like that argument, but he pointed out that there is this other approach based on property rights where they didn't have a warrant and they went and they stuck something on his car, and that's his property. And in fact, that is the argument that ultimately prevailed in the Supreme Court. The problem is it does not get you very far if what you're worried about is government having access to all kinds of personal private information about you. Because in most cases, it does not involve that kind of physical intrusion on your physical property.
You're talking about searches of, say, information that's being held on a third-party server somewhere else, or maybe cell phone location data. That's something that's come up in front of the court in recent years.
Neil Gorsuch, in this case involving cell phone location data the Supreme Court handed down last month, he had this interesting dissent where he didn't quite buy the argument that the majority was using to say that seizing cell phone location data amounted to a search. I have not seen any similar concern from Kavanaugh. And in fact, in a case involving the government's mass collection of telephone records, where basically they're looking at who you call and who calls you, then he went further and he said, not only is it not a search according to the Supreme Court precedent, but even if it were a search, it would be okay, it would be reasonable, right? Because the Fourth Amendment only bans unreasonable searches. Why? Because this is important to protect national security or, you know, prevent terrorism, whatever. So that should be troubling to anybody who's worried about third-party doctrine, who's worried about, you know, mass collection of data about you without a warrant.
Like pretty much all members of the Supreme Court, there are going to be things to like about a possible Justice Kavanaugh, and there are going to be things to be a bit worried about. I guess all we can really hope at this point is that the Senate will take their time, really dig into some of these issues, and ask some tough questions during the confirmation hearings to get as good of a sense as we can from Brett Kavanaugh where he stands on some of these important things. But we will have to wait and see, because unfortunately we're out of time for today. Thanks for taking some time with us, Jacob.
Sure. Thank you.
And again, that's Jacob Sullum. He's senior editor for Reason Magazine. You can check out his work at Reason.com and follow our ongoing coverage of Kavanaugh's confirmation there as well. I'm Eric Boehm. Thanks for listening, folks. We'll catch you right back here next week on another edition of American Radio Journal.
Donald Trump isn't the first U.S. president to find himself snared in controversy over his relationship with a Russian or Soviet president. Dr. Paul Kangor from the Center for Vision and Values at Grove City College explains on this American Radio Journal commentary.
Today's press conference in Helsinki was one of the most disgraceful performances by an American president in memory. So said John McCain in response to the Trump-Putin press conference in Helsinki on July 16th. No prior president has ever abased himself more abjectly before a tyrant. Well, easy there, cowboy. With all due respect to Senator McCain, his knowledge of American presidents and Moscow tyrants is apparently very limited. Plenty of examples would suffice, but let's start with the very first, FDR and Stalin. FDR brushed off one of his advisors, Ambassador William Bullitt, during the pivotal days of the end of World War II, telling him, "Bill, I just have a hunch that Stalin is not that kind of man. I think if I give him everything I possibly can and ask from him nothing in return, noblesse oblige, he won't try to annex anything and will work with me for a world of democracy and peace." Look at those words from FDR toward this abject tyrant, a man who killed far more people than Vladimir Putin ever has. A stunned Bullitt argued with President Roosevelt, informing the Hyde Park patrician that he was not dealing with a British duke, but with a bandit. Bullitt tried to tell FDR that there was no factual evidence that Joe Stalin was a good man. FDR, however, well, he felt differently. He saw Joe Stalin as a kind man, a gentleman, one he could work with to advance democracy and peace. The president concluded to Bullitt, "It's my responsibility, Bill, not yours, and I'm going to play my hunch." Well, his hunch was a disastrous one for what became the start of the Cold War. FDR's greatest failure, of course, came at Yalta, which was held on Stalin's home turf, the Crimea, in February 1945, where he was totally rolled by Uncle Joe, and which really launched the Cold War. I've closely read what President Trump said at that press conference with Putin in Helsinki. And to be sure, I don't like what he said at all. But bad as it may be, none of it is as bad as what FDR said and, most important, actually did. Consider, there wouldn't have been a Trump-Putin meeting in Helsinki in July 2018 if FDR hadn't conceded half of Europe to Stalin at Yalta in February 1945 and helped launch the Cold War. And none of what FDR did there has dented his iconic image among the liberals who revere him as one of America's greatest presidents and now slam Donald Trump. But go beyond FDR. My friend Ralph Peters, who I greatly respect, says that a groveling Trump licked the boots of Putin in Helsinki. Well, Trump didn't literally lick Putin's boots, but Jimmy Carter in Vienna in 1979 actually kissed the cheeks of Leonid Brezhnev. And that was a perfect metaphor for 4 years of Jimmy Carter groveling before communist dictators from Moscow to Warsaw. More examples? Okay, Trump in Helsinki didn't look as bad as JFK with Khrushchev in Vienna in June 1961, where even JFK lamented that Khrushchev, quote, "rolled right over me and thinks I'm weak." It's no coincidence that the Berlin Wall started going up in East Germany mere weeks after JFK's show of weakness. And then there was Gerald Ford's performance in Helsinki with Brezhnev in July 1975, which was pitiful. So, John McCain thinks that Trump in Helsinki was the worst performance ever by an American leader with a Russian leader? Well, not even close, I'm afraid. For American Radio Journal, I'm Paul Kengor. Check out my book, Dupes, How America's Adversaries Have Manipulated Progressives for a Century.
American Radio Journal is heard on public affairs-minded radio stations all across the country, including our newest affiliates, KLWD-FM in Gillette, Wyoming, and KWCF-FM in Sheridan, Wyoming. Welcome to our new listeners in the Cowboy State. American Radio Journal is produced weekly by the Lincoln Institute of Public Opinion Research, Incorporated. The Lincoln Institute is completely funded through the generosity of individuals, corporations, and philanthropic foundations, which underwrite the costs of this program. Comments and opinions expressed on this program are those of the guests and do not necessarily reflect the views of the Lincoln Institute or of this radio station. Learn more about American Radio Journal and hear expanded versions of some interviews aired on our program. Please visit our website, AmericanRadioJournal.com. I'm Loman Henry. Thank you for listening to American Radio Journal. American Radio Journal, lighting the brush fires of freedom.